It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning. This is John Birdsall, and this is Legal Defense. Kirk O'Bare, unfortunately, is not with us today, which is too bad because I always like chatting with Kirk about legal topics, whether it has something to do with Wisconsin or nationally or even internationally. Obviously, very well-informed and experienced lawyer that Kirk is. But Kirk is, I think, playing hooky today. And I'm sure I could probably make up something about how he has work-related duties, but I think it might have something more to do with golf, which is awesome because he totally deserves that time off. But I'm going to be with you for the next hour, and honestly, I've lined up a ton of really interesting topics. We're going to talk a little bit about the gun case that found that... in California, concealed carry is not constitutional. We're going to talk a little bit about Sheriff Clark and this kind of conflict he's having, Sheriff Clark from Milwaukee, this conflict he's having with this immigration rights group. We're going to talk about crime-fighting strategies that are being used sort of nationwide, and maybe they can be applied here. Not only in larger cities like Milwaukee, but even smaller towns, of which Wisconsin has a lot of them. We're going to talk a little bit about a recent Supreme Court case that came down regarding an illegal stop, and then admitting the evidence anyways. Fantastic. So we have a lot of ground to cover, and obviously. It'd be nice to have Kirk here to sort of kick it around with, but I certainly have more than enough on my mind to keep us going. So anyways, we'll just jump right in here. This is the first thing that really caught my eye this week was a Second Amendment case. And I should say, as an aside, this is something that fascinates me to no end, the Second Amendment. And its varied interpretations, and it has become kind of a touchstone for political battles for reasons which kind of escape me. Why this has turned into such a magnet of contention between the right and the left, really, for lack of any better term. And this has really just occurred, you know, just in the last maybe 20 years. In this country, and this was never really an issue before, but it, you know, whether or not somebody has a personal right to carry a gun, whether or not you have a right to conceal carry, whether or not the Second Amendment only applies to militias, that sort of thing. So there's various aspects to talk about, but the ruling came out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, and just for everyone's edification, our country is broken into 13 federal judicial districts, or circuits they're called. And within those circuits, all of the lower courts feed into those courts of appeals. So the Ninth Circuit covers California, and it covers several other western states. And it's typically known, you know, I don't know if this is right or wrong, but it typically has a reputation as being a little bit more of a liberal-leaning court. And I think actually some of the judges on the Ninth Circuit were in consideration for the spot that was ultimately decided by the president to give to Merrick Garland. And certainly I think that if Hillary Clinton wins election, this is going to be one of her go-to places for Supreme Court nominees. But that's another story. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Second Amendment does not protect a right for ordinary citizens to carry concealed firearms in public. And it's a major decision on the constitutional boundaries of gun rights. And this really has Supreme Court of the United States written all over it in terms of whether it's going to be taken up. I can't imagine that our present Supreme Court not accepting this case, except for they might not accept it, depending on the timing, this year. It's certainly not going to be on the docket for this upcoming term, but it might work its way in into like early next year to get on the following term. So their terms run from the first Monday in October until the end of June. So whether or not it's going to make it, I don't know. That's another thing. But let's just dig into the details here, sort of get into the weeds of what this opinion was. And then let's step back and talk about the Second Amendment as it is and as it has been interpreted and as it was written, for that matter. So the majority opinion, first of all, you should understand that most times when you go to the Federal Court of Appeals, there's only like three judges. There's usually 11 judges on the whole court, but only three judges handle any particular case. Unless it's a probably contentious case, in which case you can apply to have the entire court hear the case, and that's what happened here. So the majority opinion was written, it was 52 pages long. And what they did was, the judge that wrote it, William Fletcher, laid out an exhaustive history of British and American laws that prohibited concealed weapons. He traced a continuous thread from a decree by Edward I in 1299 to his sheriffs, all the way to a series of state Supreme Court decisions in the 19th century. And he wrote, quote, "Based on the overwhelming consensus of historical sources, we conclude that the protection of the Second Amendment, whatever the scope of that protection may be, simply does not extend to the carrying of concealed firearms in public by members of the general public," end quote. So it's a fascinating ruling and really kind of a bold one. They did not, and the vote was relatively close for a full Court of Appeals decision. It was 7-4 upholding that. So there was some dissenters here. But what was at issue was whether or not California's law, which restricted concealed carry use in its entirety. Under the current law, California residents must show, quote, good cause when obtaining a concealed carry license, and they have to get that from their local county sheriff. And it's the sheriff that decides what good cause means. Good cause is one of those legal terms that everybody uses but nobody really can define. So that prompted two people who got denied licenses to appeal. Well, the interesting part about the ruling, though, is that it explicitly refused to address whether the Second Amendment protects the right to openly carry firearms in public. And as anybody who's followed these issues knows, that's something that many gun right activists take pretty seriously. They'll walk around with, you know, assault weapons strapped around their shoulders and just walk into, you know, a mall or, you know, a kid's store, you know, whatever, just sort of prove that they have the legal right to do that. But three judges argued in a concurring opinion, because they kind of saw this going to the Supremes, that California's statute was reasonable enough to survive judicial scrutiny, even if the Second Amendment protections did apply to concealed firearms. So obviously the four judges that dissented, they thought that these guys were out of their minds, because in 2008, the late Justice Scalia wrote the now very, very famous opinion in Heller, and the following opinion, which in McDonald versus Chicago, that held that they historically have a right, citizens have a right to, a personal right to carry weapons, to own and possess firearms. And he bases that on what his interpretation of what the original meaning of that phrase is. And I think on one level that Justice Scalia got it right, that there probably was that intent at that time, 1789, when the Second Amendment was ratified, that there was some intent that people, citizens, not all citizens, of course, and of course there was many people who this didn't apply to, women, people who didn't own property, any sort of non-white people, you know, so it's, you know, we're using terms in sort of a strange context here, but there was that intent, and there was a reason for that, and I think we're going to discuss that probably over the break, but it has to do with people serving in and participating in the militias that would be called up in the event of, you know, insurrection, war, things like that, because we didn't have a standing army at that time. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more when we get back, but then we'll be pressing on to other issues. But so please stick around, listen to these important messages, and I'll be right back. This is John Birdsall sitting in for Kirk O'Bear, and this is Legal Defense.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And we are back here on Legal Defense. This is John Birdsall sitting in for Kirk O'Bear, who is off doing multiple fun things. I think there's a little golf involved. So I hope Kirk is having a great time, and I'm certainly having a great time talking about the law here on WHBL. So stick around. I hope you enjoyed those messages from our sponsors. And so when we left off, we were talking about this decision. I don't know if I want to call it radical, but it was a pretty significant gun rights decision that upheld a ban on concealed carry. Now, Wisconsin obviously has concealed carry, and a rather liberal version of it to boot. And honestly, I don't know exactly how I feel about it, but I do know that when we left, we were talking about sort of like what the basis of the ruling was. In other words, what exactly sort of underscored why this was an important issue, and also what the foundation of the reasoning was. Okay, so the Second Amendment. Let's just start with that. Let's just start with what does that mean? What does the Second Amendment actually say? So the actual text of the Second Amendment says the following here. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay. That seems like, you know, not much. It's one sentence. It's an entire amendment. most of our amendments are a little longer than that, but that one packs a punch. Now, what does it mean? Well, it clearly says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I mean, this is why I think, at least on one level, Scalia got it right. I think that is what the original intent of the founders probably was. And the reason is because of the prefix to that statement. In other words, the reason is because they wanted people to have the unconditional right to keep and bear arms, because those people, those citizens, those countrymen, the farmers, the merchants, whoever it was, they were the army. They were the army of the United States. We didn't call it that. We called it a militia. We had militias back then. And if there was going to be some fighting going on, those were the people that were going to be called up. Because if you remember, you know, just basic American history, we were very, very skeptical of having standing armies. Standing armies were something that the king had. Standing armies were used to oppress people. Standing armies were things that represented a past that the founding citizens and founding folks of our country, we distrusted terribly. Because what did it bring us? It brought us, you know, King George, and it brought us the Redcoats on colonial soil at the time, oppressing the very people who were supposed to be subject to the crown. So, even though we had some really excellent fighters and leaders like George Washington, among others, we didn't want to have that standing army. Now, eventually, obviously, we had to have a standing army. You know, we had to protect our borders, and we had to, especially as our borders expanded, that had to be done. And we won't get into, you know, taking over lands that maybe we probably didn't have the exact legal authority to do that. But be that as it may, getting back to the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia was occupied by those same people that had the right to keep and bear arms. So when we say that the people have the right to keep and bear arms, they did. But the reasoning back then was completely different context than the reasoning would be now. And of course, nobody knew what assault weapons were. Nobody knew what machine guns were. Nobody knew what, you know, a 30-round magazine was. These people had muskets. They had to stop and reload after every shot, and that was a dangerous proposition right there. But you know, that's the way it was. You know, until the only time we got multiple shooting mechanisms was when somebody invented the six shooter, and eventually the Gatling gun. But the point is that this interpretation, if you're an originalist, probably at least has some arguability, in my opinion. But I think it ignores the other part of the original intent, the originalist's sort of construction here of what it was meant for those people. So I think the name's escaping me, but one of our more recent justices that retired suggested that we add a few words to the Second Amendment to make it crystal clear, I'm not going to get this exactly right, but he paraphrased. He said, "This is what we should add. We should amend the Second Amendment to say a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms while in military service shall not be infringed." So he wanted to add that while in military service, I think that actually speaks more to the original founding fathers' ideas of what that amendment was supposed to be. So with that context, we return to this case out of California in the Ninth Circuit, the one that's certainly going to be appealed. They're certainly going to ask the Supreme Court to take that up. Now, whether this Supreme Court will, as it's currently constituted with 8 members, is another question. They have not shied away from taking tough cases, or at least trying to deliver tough cases. Just this week, they took on the case involving President Obama's immigration policy. In other words, his executive action that said, "I wasn't going to enforce certain of the immigration laws." They tied 4-4, and which in effect meant that the ruling striking down that executive order was going to be upheld. But at the same time, they did not have a decision. They did not reach a decision on the matter because they didn't have a majority. So they can't have a precedent holding decision. So the same thing may happen to this case, honestly. But now that Scalia is gone, I would say he was probably the one pushing hardest for advancing these types of cases. I don't know that there's many members that are going to do that here. I mean, Justice Thomas, you know, maybe he's probably as close as you're going to get to a Scalia mindset. But it's kind of hard to say if, you know, guns are really his issue. I think it's more like he's more like a free speech guy, individual rights guy sort of thing. But he's definitely an originalist also, which is interesting given, well, that's a whole other story. Sorry, that's a completely, that would send us into a rat hole of further discussion that we simply probably don't have time to do. But as long as we're talking about the Supreme Court, I want to talk about a case that just came down that's really kind of got me upset. And the reason it's got me upset is because the Supreme Court, when they fashion certain remedies for police misconduct, it usually wraps itself around, okay, well, if the police do an illegal search, for example, we're going to take anything they found in that search, guns, drugs, illegal cash, whatever it is they find, we're going to throw that out. They can't use that in court. And since that's usually like the whole case, that means, you know, the guy basically, quote, gets off, end quote. And so what happened in this recently released case, came out on June 20th, it's called Utah v. Strife. And it's a case I've been following actually since it arrived in the court last year. The reason it's of such great interest is because for the first time really that I can see, the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled that when the police do an illegal stop, but they discover that the person that they stopped has an arrest warrant, and they do a search anyways, even after a illegal stop, the Supreme Court said here, oh, well, you know what? The illegal stop has really no connection to the ultimate search. So therefore, we're going to allow, because they found this arrest warrant, so therefore, we're going to allow all that evidence in. Whereas all the longstanding Supreme Court precedent had been, really since the 60s, had been, illegal stop or illegality of any time, everything following that point doesn't come into evidence. That is thrown out. So we're going to have to take a little break here right now and follow up on this. This is John Birdsall for Kirk O'Bear, and this is Legal Defense on WHBL. Be right back.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And we're back here on WHBL. This is John Birdsall for Kirk O'Bear. This is Legal Defense. So when we left, we were talking about this. I hesitate to say this is an absolutely first-time decision, but this is really the first time I've seen something whereby there's illegal conduct by the police, whether that's, you know, stopping somebody for an illegal reason like racial or sexual demarcations, or using some illegal technique to interrogate somebody wherein they would throw out the confession or admission or whatever statement the person made. You know, if it's a search, they'd throw out whatever they found in the search. So in this case, what happened was that a police officer had been watching a suspected drug house. The defendant in this case, a man by the name of Strife, he walks out of the house, the officer stops him, takes his ID, relays it to the dispatcher, and the dispatcher ran it through the police database and found an outstanding arrest warrant for a traffic violation. Okay? The officer arrested Strife because of the warrant, searched him, and found methamphetamine and drug paraphernalia. Okay, so the issue was whether the discovery of the pre-existing valid arrest warrant for a traffic violation, in parentheses, connects to the unconstitutional investigatory stop, right? So, in other words, this is the order of things that went down. Police officer stops him, asks for ID. What does he have at this point? He has no reasonable suspicion to suspect this person. or at least he doesn't articulate that. So therefore, he has no basis to search him. He could do what's called a Terry frisk, which is sort of a calling this not a stop necessarily, but a reason, you know, investigatory detention. So, but right now he has no legal basis upon which to search this guy. Then he calls it in, as we progress in our timeline, he calls it into dispatch. Dispatch comes back, guy's got an arrest warrant. Boom, he's under arrest. All right, now he's under arrest. Now, if you're under arrest, you can be searched incident to that arrest. So, which trumps which? Long-standing Supreme Court precedent would say that, nope, the... you would not have gotten to the point where you discovered the search warrant, the arrest warrant, rather, if not for the prior illegality. So that came first. So all standing Supreme Court precedent would say everything after the illegal conduct, out the window. It's not coming into court. It's not coming into evidence. So if you did something illegal, then you found this arrest warrant, and then you did a search based on that arrest warrant, and you found drugs, can't use the drugs. That's what would have happened had, at least in my view, had they followed some precedent. But they didn't. And the vote was 5-3, actually. So, which is a little strange. And they used what's called an attenuation test, where they say, well, you know, the illegal conduct here was close in time, so that weighs against letting the drugs in. But we're also saying that the intervening circumstances strongly favored the state. That's what the court says. And that the valid arrest warrant predated the illegal search. The arrest warrant that the cop didn't know about, because it predated the illegal search, that they sort of like throw that back in time. I think that's crazy logic, personally. I think this is the court flipping over backwards to try and find in favor of the state. I followed this case intensely, and including the oral arguments in front of the court, and It was really clear to me, and as a court watcher, not just the Supreme Court, but many courts of appeals and a lot of district courts, where they're clearly trying to get to a result rather than using deductive reasoning to arrive wherever that reasoning brought you. Rather, they decided, all right, well, I think the state really needs to win here, and so therefore we're going to come up with this sort of... I'll say it, intellectually dishonest manner. And so, and the final thing, though, that this always gets me. So they say, first of all, the arrest warrant preceded, so therefore it trumps the illegal search. But they also said that the purpose and flagrancy of the misconduct has to be taken into account. And here, they held that the officer's conduct was, quote, at most negligent, end quote. So in other words, hey, no harm, no foul. Don't worry about it. Hey, listen, police, this is a message to all you fine police officers. You can pretty much do whatever you want. And as long as it's not too bad, we're just going to give you a wink and a nod. So go on, have a nice day. And by the way, use the evidence, whatever you find. You know, and I know that sounds a little snarky there, but it's kind of true because this is not the only case. I mean, if we had all day, we could sit here and tick off tons and tons and tons of Supreme Court and lower court cases that all use that same sort of, you know, no harm, no foul rule, right? So it's similar, or in some cases identical, to what's called the good faith exception to pretty much everything, right? So if they do something illegal, or it's clearly that they should have known better, but they kind of had good intentions, good enough, close enough for government work. And so that's really where this case lands. And it was really remarkable to me that that it got five members of the court, you know, to to basically overrule, at least implicitly, all of these other precedents over the years that say, nope, everything after the illegal, from a case called Wan Sung in the early 60s until today, it had always been that, you know, once you get that illegal conduct, that's it. So it was also interesting, and I'll just read you a brief quote here from Justice Sotomayor, who, by the way, is one great justice. She's really fantastic, but she's particularly insightful, I think, on this case. She says, quote, "This case allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, check it for outstanding traffic warrants, even if you are doing nothing wrong. If the officer discovers a warrant for a fine you forgot to pay, courts will now excuse his illegal stop and will admit into evidence anything he happens to find by searching you after arresting you on the warrant," end quote. She's right. She's 100% right. Of course, she's one of the three dissenters, and and that's just the way it's going to go. But so I thought that was a particularly disturbing case, and I think it speaks institutionally to the flow of cases and the yin and yang, if you will, of our judicial process, where, you know, sometimes it swings, you know, really in favor of the government. Certain times in our history, like in the 60s, it sort of swung in favor of defendants. And there's always this struggle between, you know, the forces that want to give the government more and more and more power and those who want to, put a check on that power. And, of course, the people that want to put the check on the power, they're accused of being anti-police, anti-law enforcement, and pro-criminal, or whatever the case may be. But I think they kind of missed the point. Because, really, even in the creation of our government, in the Constitution itself, checks on government, restrictions on government are baked in there. They're like integral parts of our Constitution and more particularly the amendments to the Constitution. You know, this case deals with the Second Amendment, but really, if you look at the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, that's all they talk about. That's all they talk about in terms of you can't do this, can't do this, can't do this. Accused have a right to this, this, and this. And that's the way it was supposed to be. That's the original intent. So even though I wouldn't say I'm an originalist, I'm not somebody who takes it at least to the extreme that Justice Scalia did, I think you have to take a modern sort of enlightened approach to real life present problems and not look at it from a 1789 time frame. But I think there is a serious argument to say that, you know, I think it's a good starting place to say this is what the founders meant, this is what the drafters meant for this particular amendment or this particular provision of the Constitution. So anyways, we're going to come back and we are going to talk about crime-fighting strategies that have worked around the country and maybe they'll work in Wisconsin when we get back on WHBL. This is John Birdsall sitting in for Kirk O'Bear.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed those tantalizing messages from our sponsors. I know I always do, and of course, as I'm mandated to do, I use all the products and services of any of the sponsors on this fine radio station. So, well, we've had some inspiring discussions here about, at least I was inspired, about a rather serious Supreme Court case and about a lower court case that came down. But now we're going to sort of like pivot away from the courts and start talking about gun violence. Now, obviously, we all know about the mass shootings that have gone on, that are spectacular and horrible and headline grabbing. So whether we're talking about Sandy Hook Elementary School, whether we're talking about shooting up a Colorado movie theater, whether we're talking about Columbine High School, whether we're talking about the most recent horrible example of the Orlando shooting, we're talking in those cases about spectacular gun violence, really attention grabbing, some of it terror related, some of it just crazy related. But really the discussion always ends up turning around to what are we going to do about gun violence writ large? In other words, the overall picture of gun violence in America. Because really, if you think of, if you count up the people in mass shootings for, there was actually a study, I think, by the New York Times or something, and they defined mass shootings as four or more people shot. And I think it came out like almost 400 mass shootings over the last year or something like that. I mean, it was an insane number. But there's every year, I believe, 17,000 gun deaths in this country, and 75,000 people who are shot. And that's the real gun violence, right? And a lot of us don't have to live in neighborhoods that are plagued by gun violence, but a lot of people do, mostly poor people, mostly in big cities, you know? And I'm very grateful that I don't have to walk out and worry about somebody toting a gun, but it's all part of the same conversation. Like, just like in that California case about concealed carry, you know, this almost fanatical desire to have every single human being in the world to have a gun just so we're all, quote, safe, is nonsensical to me. But the real question is, what are we going to do about it? And I don't mean, and for the purposes of this discussion, I don't mean what are we going to do about it in terms of gun policy. What are we going to do about it on the ground? And that's where this this initiative in Kansas City, it becomes incredibly interesting here, and it's called focused crime fighting. Okay, and what it means is here is Kansas City has developed this thing called the No Violence Alliance. Shortened to NOVA. It's a law enforcement strategy. It's known as, quote, focused deterrence, end quote. And what it involves is identifying people that are most at risk to commit or to be victimized by gun violence, often the same individuals, by the way, and they host call-ins where they are given community support and offered resources. And they're also told that they have the attention of law enforcement, that law enforcement is watching them, and they're going to face serious immediate consequences, often federal charges, and long sentences if they're arrested again. So it sounds like a pretty basic strategy. Sounds like, all right, I'm putting you on notice, Mr. At-risk person. Oftentimes, at least in larger cities, young black men, you know, just to face the reality of it, that's an unfortunate truth, but there's a lot of reasons for that too. But they're sort of like giving a nod to them in advance rather than laying in wait and waiting for more people to die. In other words, they're trying to deter crime. That's why it's called focused deterrence. And oftentimes deterrence is only used in the context of a criminal sentencing where they sentence somebody to a lengthy prison term, and that will deter you, sir, from ever doing this again, and it will also deter everybody watching here. Well, it usually doesn't, to be honest. It usually doesn't. And so, honestly, when I first heard about this effort, I was very skeptical. I thought, well, you know, deterrence as a concept sounds nice intellectually. It sounds like something that we could probably employ to some degree or another. But honestly, if you watch the revolving door in most of our courts, it's a lot of the same people coming back and back and back. So it's really the deterrence effect seems to be slight, if at all. And, you know, and that's just an anecdotal sort of like gestalt that I have. But listen to these numbers. The initial results were traumatic in Kansas City. In 2014, homicides dropped nearly 20% from the prior year to 80 victims. The city's lowest total in more than four decades. Even though the following year, the results were a little less clear-cut, officials were still undeterred. They're totally into this. So the real question is, Milwaukee had a spike of homicides last summer. So our police department, including Chief Flynn, are talking about, potentially employing this focused deterrence strategy. Here's the problem. Milwaukee's tried it before. Three different times, as a matter of fact. And part of the problem is that those attempts failed, obviously, because if they were success, I'd be talking about what a great success they were. So they failed, but they failed for institutional reasons. You know, I mean, I spend a lot of time criticizing the police for whatever misconduct they're doing and for having too much power and, you know, a host of other things. But what I often don't talk about is the necessity of police to have police forces and to have an appropriate balance in an open, free society. But, you know, recognizing that we need a legal structure and a physical force to protect us, particularly in tough, troubled neighborhoods. So when I say that, and I say that for a very specific reason, is because I think Chief Flynn, among other police chiefs and police officers, are, I think, at their very core, you know, they have good intents. They're trying to cut out violence, cut out harm to people, and bring some sanity to certain neighborhoods. And that's, of course, very commendable. The problem is, at least from my decades of experience working with in the criminal justice system and working with police forces, is that they can never work with other parts of the system. In fact, that's not just their problem. That's the problem system-wide. So the courts, the police, social workers, clergy, city government, activist groups within the community, they're all bumping into each other. Like if they were in a big pinball game, they're just bumping into each other, trying to find their way through the maze, right? And there's just accusations going back and forth. Nobody ever works together. That's why this failed three other times in Milwaukee's attempt to do what Kansas City seems to be doing rather successfully. Kansas City, by the way, among other cities in the country that are finding success with this. And the reason that Kansas City is finding success is because they are bringing in people that have a lot of credibility in those communities. And a lot of times it's mothers of slain young men who come in and tell other young men, this is what happened to my son, and this is what you did to my family, and this is what we don't want to have you involved in, and so that you can stay in the community, you know, and you can not spend the rest of your life in prison. And, you know, and it seems to be having some effect. Well, that's never really been employed here, and the institutional boundaries within which all of these groups operate seems to not be broken down, or not. There seems to be no attempt, or at least no success, in melding their efforts together. Because at the end of the day, I think most of these groups have the same objective, right? They have the same objective, but they view each other as sort of enemies instead of working together as partners. That's an institutional problem. That's a systemic problem that's really going to be tough to overcome. Well, I wish I could offer some sort of, you know, perfect solution to this, but we're kind of out of time. So I want to thank you very much for listening, and I'm going to look forward to seeing Kirk again bright and early next Saturday morning for Legal Defense. Until then, this is John Birdsall signing off. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.